So what can we use, all right, that agronomically would be suited for less rainfall or less irrigated water, and so provide the cow with, you know, really some undigestible fiber and some digestible fiber. We don't necessarily need the starch, but, you know, maybe we can get that also with it. And so the natural resource or the natural crop that's been there for a number of years, but it has primarily been fed to heifers, is sorghum silage, right? Or sorghum Sudan. You know, there's all different variants of it.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm very happy to welcome to the show Dr. Patrick French. Patrick, thanks for joining today.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation, Barry.
Maybe we can start off. Your affiliation is you're the principal consultant and the founder of PF Bovidae. Can you explain that to me, the name and what the group does?
So we began or founded about a decade ago, or actually a little bit more than that, initially as a holding company for some other investments I had in different businesses. And then over time, it's morphed into what I do principally today, almost full time, would be consulting for dairies, on-farm consulting for dairies, primarily in the High Plains area of the U.S., so Kansas to call it the Panhandle of Texas primarily. That's where most of my clients are located.
Very good. And I'm curious about your background. If I'm not mistaken, you didn't grow up on the High Plains. Where did you grow up? Did you start in agriculture or what?
Yeah, so I grew up in Kentucky on a small dairy and diversified farm. So, you know, some milk cows, beef cows, tobacco. It was pretty common back in the day. And then I'd say my first career was academia, undergrad, graduate school. Then I spent a few years at Oregon State University, teaching and research. So that'd be, I'd call that the first chunk of my career. Then I moved into technical consulting for different companies, we'll say for the mid part of my career, my midlife. And then thereabouts, I had we'll call it a midlife crisis. And, you know, time's running out and thinking about how I want to finish my career. And I always thought I wanted to do on-farm consulting and had the opportunity to start servicing some really intriguing, motivated clients in the High Plains, and jumped on that opportunity, and off we went.
So some might say you're still in the middle of your career. Maybe you're intending to retire young, huh?
No, not intending, but yeah, time's moving fast.
I know what you mean. So yeah, you started out kind of in the Southeast, ended up in the North Pacific Northwest, and then sort of doing a lot of your work on the High Plains now.
Yeah, yeah. So I live on the East Coast and commute primarily to my clients. It seems to be the further you live away from your clientele, the more of an expert you are.
So, there you go. So I'm curious, before we kind of dive into a more narrow topic, for those who haven't, you know, I've spent some time on the High Plains, but for those who haven't, you know, seen a lot of dairies in that part of the world, how would you describe a typical High Plains dairy, I guess?
Typical today would be, you know, primarily the new facilities going in, for the most part, be cross-fed barns, right, which aren't unique just to the High Plains. You'll find those, you know, at least throughout the Midwest to the High Plains. The owners milk in multiple parlors. It's not always multiple sites, but if they don't have multiple sites, they tend to have multiple parlors, and I'd say quite large herd sizes compared to most of the U.S.
Typically, they're taking advantage of, you know, easy manure management because of low rainfall and lack of neighbors making it easier to scale up.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. Yeah, lack of neighbors would be the right way to put it. I should say all the farms or all the new expansions or cross-vent barns, there's still expansion occurring in open lots or open corrals.
Okay.
Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build effective and easy to use. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
Well, the topic we want to dig into today is a little bit about utilizing sorghum silage as opposed to corn silage. And well, maybe we should start there and talk about a little bit of the history of that. How long have people been playing with that in the High Plains, and where did that start on, in terms of feeding animals on the farm?
Yeah, so when I got approached to participate in the podcast, you know, trying to think of, you know, something different and unique, at least for the area of the country that I primarily service, it would be, you know, what's going to be the forward source of the future. In the future would be what, maybe in the next 5-7 years, what's going to be the primary forage source that we're going to feed to dairy cattle. So as you mentioned, somewhere in the conversation, fairly arid, right? So manure management's easier, a lot of open land, so expansion is easier. But with that, the water resources apparently are diminishing in that part of the world. And you spent a number of years there and understand that very well in Kansas. But you know, looking forward, so we can import our starches, our proteins, even our high fiber byproducts, right? We can get those there, but you know, economically, you know, getting forage there is going to be difficult. So what can we use, right? That agronomically would be suited for less rainfall or less irrigated water, and so provide the cow with, you know, really some undigestible fiber and some digestible fiber. We don't necessarily need the starch, but you know, maybe we can get that also with it. And so the natural resource or the natural crop that's been there for a number of years, but it has primarily been fed to heifers, is sorghum silage, right? Or sorghum Sudan. You know, there's all different variants of it. I did learn when I started servicing clients in Kansas is that there's this crop grown called feed. Right. And you giggle. And at first I was like, well, what is feed? But it's kind of anything that grows out there that, that, you know, you can feed to heifers. So it could be Sudan. It could be sorghum Sudan, hay grazer, sorghum itself. What else? Yeah. Even many times maybe they throw trit or rye in there, but right. It's feed. And so, but we have to improve upon that feed and, you know, plant things that are going to, you know, provide some digestible fiber right to the cow. And so sorghum has been grown there for a long time, but now we're thinking about, okay, which varieties do we plant, right, to maximize digestible fiber to the cow? And then, you know, do we want starch in this product, or do we want it devoid of starch? I think those are the things that we're playing around with. You know, all of my clients in some capacity are dabbling in sorghum. Either they're wading in it fairly deep, right, chest deep, neck deep, and others are just sticking their toe in the water. But they recognize that that they need to be able to pivot soon and switch away from probably corn silage to sorghum silage as a primary forage for dairy cattle.
Let's dig in a little bit to the practicalities or what's pushing people. Is it mostly a sense of, look, we've got to do better with water conservation, or is it literally my corn silage last year was terrible because I didn't have enough water to put on it from my well, or is it both?
Yeah, my perception, it's a bit of both, right? Conserving the resources going forward, right? So that we can extend the longevity of the dairy industry in that part of the world. And then secondly, it's that we already have you know, some circles or fields that we can't grow, you know, anything on. Per se, maybe analogy would be if I had three circles, I could grow corn on one, right, and divert water from the other two to supply water for that one circle, or I could grow two circles of sorghum on that three circles of land. Yeah, and so that'd be the immediacy of it, right? The practicality of, hey, we got to do something today because we simply don't have enough water to grow crops on some land, right? And then secondly, I think it would be moving forward as water districts reduced allocation of water going forward. You know, that will force us to plant different crops on different land.
The example you gave, I know it's is probably a rough approximation, but is that pretty accurate? Where you can grow twice as much acreage wise, twice as much sorghum as corn with the same amount of water?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit overstated. I think maybe it's 150%.
Okay.
Right. So if I had maybe a better example, if I had two circles, one is fallow, or I'm diverting water from one to the other to grow one circle of corn. If I convert both of those to sorghum, I can grow 1.5 circles. Yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of actually feeding it, then, as you said, people have been using this in heifer rations for some time. And I know, it's been some time since people first started dabbling with what does this look like in a lactation diet. If you just went whole hog and said I was feeding 40% of my diet as corn silage and I just switched that straight to a normal, good quality sorghum silage, what would you expect to see as a response?
Yeah, if we switch 1-to-1, of course, we're going to lose production, right? Because, good corn silage should be at least half corn grain. Right. And deliver, even in that part of the world, 35% starch or so would be, average corn silage in the plains. And if we switch to a heifer sorghum, it's essentially devoid of starch. Right. And so our starch content of the ration, is going to go from, say, 28 to 18 or so. And our UNDF is going to increase dramatically. And I remember that maybe when I was in the West Coast many years ago. And so like the small grain forage, they would call it winter forage, right? It's whatever cover crop that they would harvest. And the comment from a dairyman was, well, cows don't milk on winter forage. And I always I thought that was an interesting comment, right? But didn't quite understand. But once I understood what they were doing, then of course they didn't milk on winter forage because they would replace corn silage, right, with either wheat, trit, wheat trit, or that was primarily it. And so you were replacing something that had probably more digestible fiber, certainly higher starch, with something that was devoid of starch. And so that would be the same thing I would expect with sorghum, right? If we switch 1-for-1, in some of the early research, if you go back to the 80s, right, in Journal of Dairy Science and dig up some of this early sorghum work, where they simply, it was a replacement, one forage for the other. And that's what you would observe as a reduction in milk production intake followed by milk production.
So, yeah, obviously that doesn't work very well. And so are people pushing now towards, can we harvest later so we're getting some starch? Are they looking towards varieties that are inherently more digestible in the fiber fraction? What's the focus right now?
Yeah, so certainly improving the fiber digestibility. BMR is a likely candidate. Some folks agronomically don't like BMR sorghum because of standability or lodging. But even, there's some better non-BMR varieties that have higher NDF digestibility. But, if we just take a broad brush and look at NDF D30 on just a variety of sorghums from non-BMR to BMR, it's the best. The best sorghum still lag the average corn silage in terms of 30-hour NDF digestibility, right? The BMR varieties can approach the average corn silage, right? So, we're probably mid to high 40s on NDF 30 on sorghum silage, and even average to a below average corn silage would be, 55 or so, right? Just a decent one that's not even BMR should be in the low 60s. So we're giving up a lot of NDFD off the bat with sorghum. So, but, we can balance around that. We'll just, we'll balance for essentially UNDF, right? 240. It's just going to take a lot fewer pounds of sorghum to get us there than it did corn silage. And so we can figure the fiber thing out, right? That's just variety selection primarily. The starch will be maybe more interesting as it unfolds. Do we want starch, right, in the sorghum? How much water does it take to lay the starch down? Because it's the last thing that's going to get laid down in the plant, right? And if water resources, if we're trying to conserve them, maybe we don't want sorghum with starch, right? We can continue to import our starch from somewhere else if it's going to deplete those variable resources. But we also have some other tools in the toolbox if we want sorghum with, you know, mid 20s on starch, right? Many of my clients put up at least some amount of berry processed sorghum last year, right? And so the berry processor is, you know, fairly aggressive to process, of course, those small berries. With that, we're still lagging corn silage starch digestibility by probably 20 points. So, for example, maybe an average in situ 7-hour starch on corn silage, well-fermented corn silage, would approach low to mid-80s. Even on a well-fermented berry processed sorghum silage, you know, maybe we can approach the mid-60s. Right. And so we're always going to lag starch digestibility, at least with the tools we have today, versus corn silage. But, you know, if we can get the starch laid down for minimal water, right, and there is some premium to process the sorghum berries because it does slow us down a bit, takes a bit more fuel, takes a special processor. I'm not aware that we can do it with a corn processor. I think we need more aggressive processor. So, you know, we're going to need to spend some extra money. So we're just now starting to feed some of that material. I wouldn't say it's even an on-farm test or a demo. You know, growing it, processing it, you know, doing some lab analysis is where we're at today.
And if you harvest before there's really any starch, is there enough sugar in the plant to get a good fermentation and drop the pH to stabilize the forage, or is that an issue sometimes?
Yeah, there are some high sugar varieties out there. I haven't played with them yet, but it would be an alternative, right, for starch, just if they're high sugar. And they're even in the lower sugar, normal sugar varieties, there's still enough to drive that fermentation profile, right, if we follow all the correct practices of inoculant, packing, you know, right, chop link, dry matter, and so forth. Yeah.
So, and I'm curious, so you said almost all the dairies you're working with are at least dabbling in this. I guess nobody's like relying completely on this for their forage program at this point.
Yeah. I'd say it's a spectrum berry in that, you know, we put up some and, you know, we're feeding a few pounds to milk cows. I have at least a couple of clients that intermittently throughout the year, sorghum would be the sole source of silage for them, right? Yeah. So we've jumped into it because they have maybe their lifespan on corn silage is less than 5 years. And so, yeah, we got to figure it out today, not tomorrow, right? So I'd say it's went fairly well. There's still quite a bit of corn grown out that way, right? And there's still opportunity either to put up high moisture corn or earlage fairly economically. Don't have to ship it too far. And so in those sorghum rations, we come back in with earlage at this point in time. So we're trying to mimic a corn silage crop. And fairly good success, I'd say we've had with it over the last year.
You know, almost everybody is used to thinking of land as their most limiting resource, right? So we always just default to talking about yields on a per acre basis, right? But it's interesting to think about you talking about pieces of land laying fallow and stuff. Really, already in that part of the world, a lot of ag is driven by water being the most limiting resource, really. So we should almost be thinking about first and foremost tons per, I don't know, million gallons of water or whatever the right units would be. I don't know if you've thought about that, but I assume corn silage there with enough water will yield more than sorghum silage, but maybe not per unit of water.
I haven't really, that's a good point on the efficiency of water use. I haven't got to that point yet.
Okay.
But to, you know, even, so in an average year, corn silage will yield, 50% more than sorghum.
Okay.
But simply because of the weight of the grain.
Sure.
Right. In a dry year, sorghum yields better than corn, right, because it's more drought resistant and resilient. But also, we don't need as much sorghum as we would corn, because especially if we're going to varieties that are low in starch or essentially devoid of starch. So, you know, a heifer sorghum would typically be, you know, should be less than 5% starch, right? Because the starch has no value. It passes through the animal. And so if we grow it and we pay for it, then it's just a loss, in my opinion. But if we grow or put up sorghum with 3% starch, essentially it's all fiber, some protein, could be high in sugar. you know, we only need, you know, 60% of what we did if we were growing corn.
Yeah, and it's such a different way of thinking, because I think in areas with lots of rainfall and good soil, you take for granted the fiber that you grow. Like it's an afterthought, but you're exactly right. It's like you said, we can import everything really cost effectively except fiber. And that's your main point. So you really, yeah, maybe you should be thinking about NDF per unit of water or something mm-hmm. like that, right?
Right.
It's interesting.
Our Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC, designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. Our Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors combined promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
Well, what are the big gaps? I mean, you kind of alluded to some of them. You're playing with some questions with the farms you have. Are there big questions, like more ambitious things that you think USDA or other, you know, like big research entities should be tackling in this space?
Yeah. So as mentioned, the biggest opportunity or the biggest gap, the biggest unknown at this point in time would be, you know, do we need starch in the sorghum, right? How much extra water is it going to take to lay it down? Given the differences in digestibility currently today of sorghum starch versus corn solid starch, should that even be a focus, right, on increasing either berry size or even having a berry on the plant? You know, is there ways to improve the digestibility, right, beyond the current value that we think it has, right? Can it approach corn?
Yeah, and some of our conversation here, I think, would be really interesting for like some of my students to listen to and think about. What is it that a quote unquote nutrition consultant does today? You're talking about things that certainly interface with ration formulation, and you talk about formulating around a crop that fits the environment, fits the conditions there. But obviously you're talking about a lot of ways of thinking about things that go beyond sitting there with formulation software too, right? So, I mean, what advice would you give, like, to say my graduate students that are preparing themselves to be nutrition consultants for, you know, maybe 40 years moving forward? If you put yourself in their shoes, how would you be preparing yourself for that job evolving over time?
You know, as our farms get, as they scale up and they get, you know, larger, we got, you know, many pens of cows versus, and we only have one ration, but we've got lots of pens of cows and many loads of feed going to different pens. You know, if we're mixing more than one load of a ration, and then, you know, we can have at least two treatments, you know, and if we can deliver treatments more different rations to multiple pens, taking the skills you've learned in terms of research design, right, analytics, and how do we apply that at the farm level, right, to maximize or optimize production for each farm, right? So if we're going sorghum, well, let's figure out how to test it, right, on each unit, and optimize, right, the amount or the other ingredients to complement the sorghum on each farm. So yeah, they should have those skills coming out of school, right? I mean, it's trial design, which, you know, previously we wouldn't use that on farms, right? But I think going forward, especially in different parts of the country, just based on scale, mm-hmm. right? And it'll be, you know, repeatable, you know, properly analyzed, right? On farm research, you know, it won't be, you know, demos per se. We could still do those, but, you know, we really need, you know, sound science information, you know, coming back so that we can make decisions on how we're going to, you know, continue. And using other tools so that you can, because after they leave the Bradford lab, right, they know about as much as they're ever going to know, right, at least in terms of, you know, basic science and analyzing things like that. And so it's staying engaged in new things that come along, right, and using those tools, you know, to better themselves.
I think that's really sharp. Oh, wow. It plays to my biases anyway. I talk to people a lot about how a lot of your the dairies you work with on the High Plains, right? They have neighbors half a mile down the road that have had a PhD on staff and a feedlot for a decade or more, right? Like actually running controlled studies. It's a little easier on a feedlot because cattle enter a pen, stay there until they're harvested. But still, there's a lot we can learn from. And the dairies are at a scale now where that kind of thing makes a lot more sense, I think.
Maybe a bit more complicated, like you said, than the feedlot. But, our the managers, owners of dairies are, have the wherewithal to, execute this, right, if you can put it in front of them.
Very sharp. Yep, absolutely.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Modern bacteria create biofilms, and biofilm-related issues are at the core of most culling reasons on modern dairy farms. AHV provides the only program for biofilm management in cows and calves. How much of your herd's potential gets choked out by biofilm each year? To learn more, visit www.ahvint.com/QS.
Excellent. All right. So we got our three questions that we've got to throw at you. First of all, do you have a favorite dairy related book or resource that you turn to frequently?
Yeah. And this is probably the same as every other guest that you speak with. So it'd be the Nutrient Requirements of Dairy Cattle, right? It's the 8th edition. That's the newest. But, before that, it was the 7th. And so that is the resource, right, if you're into nutrition.
Every time I look at it, it still surprises me how much insight is contained on every page there. It's pretty impressive. Yeah. All right. What about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Yeah. So it wouldn't be a book, but it'd be a resource, either Perplexity, right, which is AI, or ChatGPT. Really summarizing information, like I did in lieu of this or to prepare for this, I just went in and typed in, replacing corn silage with sorghum silage in the diets of dairy cattle, right? And it spit out all the information that you would expect. Sorghum lack or, is lower in fiber digestibility, is lower in starch, starch digestibility is lower, and so forth. But in all those things, right, I'd read or been exposed to. So I think it's important still to know where the resources are, right? So JDS, Applied Animal Science, right? I need to read, right? All the basic or all the research that's been done. But, to summarize it, man, that takes a long time, right? Either for me to write it down, type it in, and so forth. So if I'm aware of the information and if it's correct or not, right, I can simply ask the AI to summarize it for me. And it'll even make a PDF and put my header on there, right? And I can send it to my clients, but understanding, what's correct and what's not, right? And so I can edit the document. Really, that's where I use it. I've even used AI to write, a letter of support for a grant proposal that someone was, is a USDA grant, right? And I didn't want to take, the 30 minutes or 45 minutes. But if I just type in the highlights of it, it gave me a pretty good framework, right? Then I could edit it, right, to fit the specific need, and there we go. So I need to understand how to use it better, right, in my daily routine. But everybody needs to get on board with that.
Yeah, probably like you, having a lot of discussions right now with people, like, how are you using these tools or not? And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. If you know a decent amount about something, but like you don't talk about it every day, you're not on the tip of your tongue, that's maybe ideal. Cause like you said, you can sniff out what it might have invented out of thin air. But save you a lot of time. Yeah, I think that's a kind of a sweet spot for it. Interesting. All right. Last question. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
That's a great question. So, of course, this is an opinion question. So in your opinion, what sets successful professionals apart? Maybe 20 years ago, I think it was like the art of dairy nutrition. Because there was many unknowns. Well, I think 20 years ago, NDFD, well, I guess it was 48 at that point in time, was, you know, kind of fairly new, right? And we knew that forage is different in ingestibility, but we couldn't rank them or characterize it very well. And I think that's where the art came in, understanding different growing conditions resulted in different ingestibilities, you know, over different crop years. And those folks who had the experience, wisdom of going through those trying times, you know, that was the art of it. I think, you know, as our forage chemistry progresses and just the access to information progresses, I think it's been able to get your arms around, right, all the info that's coming at dairies. And so what will set successful dairy professionals apart will be, you know, those that, you know, can either, I shouldn't say tackle big data, but be able to just bring different data streams together. Right. I mean, we have, you know, of course, feed intake and milk production and components. And, you know, some of my clients, you know, are already tracking that with different dashboards. Right. That either that come from out of house and many times in house. Now they have some expertise that they're building these. It's tapping in, you know, to those and, you know, and some other data streams that come to you. And we don't have to know how to do it all, but certainly having access to people with the wherewithal, right, to assist us in that is important. Using different types of AI, I think, will be important. And then being able to analyze data. I analyze certainly not as much data today as I once did, but, I'm analyzing data often. It's just a different type of data, right, to spot trends. And are we gaining ground or losing ground? Is the sorghum working? Is it not working?
Yeah, right. To your point, maybe having the knack to sniff out what's important versus what's noise, right? Yeah, in terms of even what to look at, and that's getting harder every day with the amount of stuff coming at it.
Right.
Yeah, well, hey, thanks a lot for this conversation, Patrick. I've enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Barry. Appreciate it.
Again, our guest today has been Dr. Patrick French on the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. And if you haven't followed the show, make sure you hit that like button so you don't miss the next episode. And we will see you then.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.